Just a little bit of kind of getting the listener up to speed on what's happening in the life of Julian Schwartz these days before we dive into the Music for a Great Space program. Tell me about this All-Star Orchestra gig coming up. That sounds pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting. My father's been working on it for a while, actually for years it seems now, just on the idea and on the specifics and the project. It's just an orchestra filled with who he believes to be the stars of the current orchestral world in the United States. And he put them all together, and he wanted to pair very well-known staples in the orchestral repertoire with lesser-known American works. And he did this, I mean, so well, and I've seen some of the shows that I've seen some of the edits and some of the early versions, and it's just spectacular. Yet, they needed also new American concertos, and it was short notice, and so they picked a violin piece, a cello piece, and a piano piece. And the cello piece, I happened to be the only one to play, and it was only one performance. It was a piece of Sam Jones that I premiered in 2010. So I got the once in a lifetime chance to play with this amazing orchestra with this spectacular piece. And there was also a pianist who played a piece of Richard Danielpour, and a violinist, wonderful violinist, who's actually comes to Greensboro a lot to play, and was just down there playing with the orchestra, Yevgeny Kutik, playing the Schwantner Poets Hour. So there are a lot of new pieces and exciting things, and I hope it's a big hit with the audiences and with the TV watchers.
That's right, a nationally broadcast program for public television, and you can get a recording session from Naxos out of that.
Yes, no, I mean, it's so exciting, and Naxos is releasing the performance is a DVD and a video, and also it's going to be broadcast, as you know, on the television and whatnot. And so it's just such an exciting project.
Now, you're not a newcomer to working with Naxos after recording In Memoriam by your father for Music and Remembrance series, and then the Saint-Saëns first and Haydn C major cello concertos. What were those recording sessions like? What do you take away from a I call it a high pressure decision because it is, I mean, that's high pressure. But I've heard Naxos is a good group to work with. How did it go?
Well, Naxos is, I mean, I think it's the best, and they have so many new projects coming up, and they are distributing more than anyone in the classical music industry, as everyone knows. And I just think it's an amazing company. And at first, my first recording, the little piece that my father wrote, about the 10-minute piece for cello and string orchestra, or on the recording as I did with the string quartet, I was still very young, and so I didn't really know about recording, I didn't really know how to go about it, and so I guess my ignorance made it a less pressure-filled situation. I just played, and the producer said, you know, play this again or that again, and it was all fine. With the concertos, it was much more nerve-wracking because I knew that was about probably 3-4 years after I did the In Memoriam recording, and it was with my father and with the orchestra, not just a string quartet, and it was two big concertos, and that was a big learning experience because I needed to know what to do over, what to listen for in my own playing, and how to refine it to the point of recording, because in some ways, recordings, you know, need to be even more perfect than the live performance, and just in expectation of the listener, as you know. And so that was very stressful. That said, the most stressful beyond any stretch of my imagination was the Jones, was the All-Star Orchestra, because not only was it comprised of the greatest musicians in the country, many of whom I respect, and I would like to get their signatures on a piece of paper. But there was also no rehearsal time. From the first note I played, there were cameras on me, and we basically just played the piece twice. And I hadn't played it in 2 years, and nobody else had played it, and I was very, very committed to playing it from memory, which I did at the premiere. But in this situation, it was, you know, you either get it done in the 2 times you play it, or you're left with whatever you've done that day. And with the video, there's very little editing that can be done, if any, because of the sync issues and trying to make sure everything fits where it fits. So that, I was a wreck leading up to that that recording because I just couldn't believe what I was in for. You know, it was funny. I was a couple days before it, I was calling out my father. How could you do this to me? I'm just mentally scared, and I mean, I shouldn't be saying these things. But it was very stressful, and I'm very happy to say that all that stress paid off because it went very well, and I was very happy with it. But leading up to it was, these people are such great musicians and artists, and you don't want to blow it, and everyone in the orchestral industry knows something about your playing or something. But I held up my end of the deal, so I was very relieved.
Well, congratulations. Was Sam there for that performance as well to add to the pressure?
Yes. Sam was there for the performance. And, you know, instead of Sam, I don't know if you know Sam personally, but he is one of the most gentle, wonderful people I've ever met. And if there was anyone to make me feel more at home and more comfortable, it was Sam. And my father, you know, because Sam is so wonderful, and he's just so happy that the piece is getting performed, and we've always collaborated very well together. And in some ways, my father also put me at ease a little bit, because even though I wanted to prove to him that I was worth his invitation to play, and that I could hold up my end of the deal, I still, you know, he still made me feel calm, and to know that there was a guy. Not only did he have to know the Jones, but he had to know, you know, 10 symphonies and 15 short pieces all in the course of 4 days. So who should have been more stressed, me or him? Him. So that put me at ease a little bit. So
that's great. And of course, folks here in the Triad are very well aware of your playing and your father's conducting here with the Eastern Music Festival. Gerard Schwartz, what have you picked up from your dad kind of moving forward with your playing? Like just a nugget or two, and then I want to know what maybe he's picked up from you these last several years.
Well, I've always been a big fan of playing for my father, and just if I'm working on a concerto or if I'm working on a recital. I mean, just yesterday in preparation for the recital in Greensboro, I played the whole program for him with the pianist and whatnot, because I'm a great believer that the instrumentalist that is your teacher or looks at everything through the lens of what your instrument's capable of doing. So certain things I've found that cellists let go because they understand the physical problems and the difficulty with doing certain techniques, where my father is looking at it purely as a musician and how to refine the music making purely, not necessarily the cello playing or making excuses for the cellist. So of the nuggets he's given me, I mean, basically musical, making longer phrases, making more interesting phrases. That's always been something that he's been a strong supporter of. And things like balance and things like how to communicate, but mainly the musicianship and the composer's intention, trying to really play like a singer. Those are all things that really run through all of our working together. As far as what he's learned from me, I don't know if, you'd have to ask him, but I don't know if there's anything he's learned from me. Maybe some of my, you know, because every piece I know or that I discover or that I ever try to, or I think is obscure, he already knows. And he knows everything, so there's nothing really that I can know more. Yet, when I was playing in a string quartet, my interest in chamber music was at an all-time high, and I was just so absorbed in all of the repertoire that I hadn't really been exposed to as a child, because I grew up in sort of an orchestral household. I don't know if that exists, but if it does, that was my household. So there was not much chamber music. So in some ways, I've listened to in the car and told my father about different pieces that he probably knew either peripherally or he'd heard, but didn't have the close personal relationship with the pieces like I did. So maybe somewhere in there I told him about a nice piece or two.
I love that idea that and I talked with your dad about this once before too, that the long phrase, it really right. Separates the good performer from the truly great ones.
Yeah, I think so. And it's funny because I always try to do it. And I mean, yesterday I was playing for him and I'm doing his type of phrasing, my type of phrasing. I mean, I do everything he wants, except, you know, for out of 70 minutes of music, he can find 2-3 minutes where I'm not quite doing it, you know, and though that's okay, and most people don't even do the amount of phrasing that I do or he does, still, there's that integrity that goes along with making sure you're doing it all the time and holding yourself to the highest standard. You know, it's tough but inspiring.
Yeah, that's great. I talked, just coincidentally, was chatting with, I had an interview with James Galway yesterday. He's coming to...
Oh, wow, wonderful.
He's going to be here with the Winston-Salem Symphony in a couple weeks, I guess, early April. Yeah, and it was really neat. I mean, he's obviously, I think I was, you know, number three interviewer of the day, and I'm sure he was tired, but very generous with his time. One of the responses I thought was very interesting. I've always wondered, at that level, and I think I asked Emmanuel Axe a similar question, you know, what you've done, you've played all these concertos. He's played the Mozart second, you know, hundreds of times, and he's, right. He's recorded the whole repertoire for the flute. He was principal in Berlin, for gosh sakes,
right.
For 6 years.
Absolutely.
He's played all the rep.
Those years.
So I said, what motivates you now? I mean, I didn't say, I'm sure he's coming up on 70, if not beyond it, but what gets you out of bed? What makes you want to do this? And you know what he said? He said, I made some allusion to golf. He's down in Boca right now with his wife. And I said, he said, you know why? Because I want to get the ball in the hole. I want to get it perfect. He says, if I'm playing a piece and that first C sharp I hit isn't right in the middle where I want it, or the sound isn't exactly what I want, I want it. What I love is the next time working it out so I hit it just perfect. And he says, I'm that way with my plumbing. I'm that way with trimming my hedges. I'm just, that's what motivates. And I thought, how cool is that to be in performance, going for it to the extent where you look forward to those moments where you got to up your game?
Right.
And I'm curious, just from this stage in your career, what motivates you? What gets you up to put yourself through this sometimes torturous process of performing in front of huge audiences?
That's very interesting. There are a few things that come to mind. One is where I live, New York City. I mean, the amount of cultural events, the amount of performances that I can see, it's the amount of musicians that do what I do, that care about what I care about, is unbelievable. And I never really lived here until starting last year. And it really inspires me, because I was always, as a kid, going to concerts, hearing great soloists, then coming home and practicing because I felt inspired by the concert. You know, so that still applies. Also, you speak about James Galway. My girlfriend's a flutist, and she's extremely devoted to the craft of playing the flute. And she's taking a year off at the moment and practicing. And the type of specificity with which she does that, and the analysis that goes into it, inspires me to get into my practice room and do what I need to do. In terms of what Sir James, is that what you say? In terms of what Sir James said, I'm not quite at that point, because I'm still at the point where if my C sharp's not quite in, if I'm not quite in the center of the note, or something's not quite right, there's only beating myself up about it. Because for me, I want everything to be perfect, and of course I'm still idealistic and think that I can do everything perfect every time, and so there's no question that the next time, if I mess something up, the next time I have to play it perfectly. But the only thing is that I haven't in that moment, and so I'm upset about that. But also my father, you know, seeing this All-Star project, seeing all this come together, it was inspiring for me. And he's someone who's in his mid-60s and is starting a new project, which requires so much energy and so much thought. And for me, I'm thinking about, wow, will I be able to do that when I'm that age? And it puts me on the right course. So,
yeah, that's great. Thanks for that. I appreciate it.
Of course.
Ben, you put together a monster program for this tribute to Henry Ingram, the Memorial Concert.
I'm very excited about it.
My gosh. I mean, it's just one great piece and such variety. Was this over, I'm just putting the program together for starters. How did that process begin, and what sorts of considerations did you have going forward?
Well, for me, in making the program, I'm sort of old-fashioned in that I used to look at Heifetz's recital programs and Piatigorsky's recital programs, and what they did, it's mostly, not this is sort of out of style now, but what they did mostly is have a nice opener and a big sonata, intermission, a bunch of short pieces, someone who still does it is Itzhak Perlman. So I wanted to do sort of, I always like to do sort of a variation of that. So I have a few big sonatas that I just think are masterpieces. And I think that with the longest pieces, the audience has the most attention span in the beginning, as I do, as I notice that I do in recitals. So I give a nice classic opener, which is elegant, which I like to do, and then play a big sonata, have the break, come back, play one piece by myself, which I usually like to do, and then a bunch of short pieces that really offer a lot of variety. I have a slow French piece and a fast German piece and a solo suite by a, you know, sort of a Spanish composer with French influences, with Spanish dances involved. And then, of course, there's Gunnerweiss and the Gypsy Airs for a nice showy ender. And also the considerations I have are where I'm playing these recitals, what I've played in those cities, and usually it's not a consideration because I'm making my start, and usually it's my first opportunity. But the week after I go to Greensboro, I'm playing the same recital in Palm Springs. And 2 years ago, I played a program that was like this, but different pieces, you know, the same format, but different repertoire. And I, you know, that's a perfectly wonderful program, and I would have loved to use it in Greensboro. But for the timing, I couldn't use any of the same pieces for this Palm Springs recital, so I had to sort of think outside the box. And it just caused me to... And also, I've been exposed to a lot more cello pieces than I was when I made the last program. So the last program was Schumann Fantasy Pieces and the Mendelssohn D Major Sonata and Ligeti Solo Sonata, like I said, the solo piece, and other short pieces, the Barber Sonata. And this time I wanted to keep it fun. So the second half, I think, is really fun.
Oh, yeah.
With this solo cello piece, which I've never played in recital, but I've played in performances. And I think it showcases the cello. And it's always nice, I think, to play something solo to give the pianist a little rest and also show the solo capabilities of the instrument, which, though I think, are in some ways limited because of the lack of counterpoint and harmony sometimes that occurs. I do think it's important. And I did do something odd in the program a little bit by taking two different pieces from bigger pieces. The Sonata and Satz of Brahms, which was just the scherzo from a sonata written by sort of a conglomerate sonata, consortium sonata or something with Schumann, Dietrich, and Brahms, and they all wrote different movements. And of course, the Brahms movement is the you know, for me, one of the great masterpieces in that piece, so why not play it by itself? And then the Quartet for the End of Time slow movement, it's some of the pieces I like very much by Messiaen, but I can't bring a clarinetist and a violinist and have a 50-minute piece. But so the slow movement from the Quartet for the End of Time won't have the same kind of meaning in the context of all of his original intention. But I don't mind looking at it as just a hauntingly beautiful, harmonically progressive slow movement in sort of a French style.
I thought going back to back like that was that's really like the highlight of the for me looking at the program. That really captured me because I think of Brahms as just living in that mid-range beautiful vocal quality of the cello,
right.
And then Messiaen really wrote well for the instrument in that piece as well as the clarinet and the other instruments. But what a neat back to back. How do you flip the switch that for the performer? They're going from period to period like that. Is it a challenge, or do you just immediately get into 20th century mode? How does that work?
That's a great question because I've done recitals where there have been a lot of different pieces where back to back. This one, there are more shorter pieces and more of them. So instead of three longer pieces, there are maybe four or five shorter pieces. And for that, you know, I really don't know how I'm going to switch the styles. The easiest thing to do would be to talk about the pieces in between. So you give the audience something to think about. And then I could give myself a little rest and clear the air. I don't know if it would work going directly from the ending of the big C major chords at the end of the Brahms to this completely different harmonic language, as you say. But I do think that with the right amount of pause and the right amount of internal sort of me convincing myself that I'm in a static place where I'm prepared to play the Messiaen, I think it'll be effective.
Yeah. Well, I love the way the program starts. I was a clarinet player and enjoyed the little Beethoven trio for cello, clarinet, and piano. The lighthearted nature of that. Kind of a different than the Beethoven we've come to know and love is the dour, intense
right.
master.
Exactly.
Talk about the variations a little bit to begin the program.
Well, the variations, I think, are wonderful. I was actually introduced to them by the concertmaster of the Eastern Music Festival, Jeff Molter.
Oh.
He wanted a nice little opener for one of their chamber concerts a couple years ago, maybe 2-3 years ago. And he suggested this piece, and I hadn't played it. And for me, I had been under the false impression that those variations were mainly piano pieces with, you know, cello bass lines. And I looked at these variations, and they were just unbelievably subtle and Beethovenian as much as they had the theme of Mozart. You know, I've always been a fan of Schubert and Mozart's melodic capabilities and Beethoven's invention, you know, and so I feel like in some ways with these variations, you get best of both worlds. You get the beautiful melody from the magic flute, the aria from the magic flute, and you get the amazing thoughtfulness that Beethoven brings to all the variations.
There was just a performance of the 33 variations, the play, and in which there's a pianist on stage playing basically the Diabelli variations throughout the course of the play. And it just made me realize once again what an amazing. I mean, you talk about inventiveness, Beethoven and variations, a true master. It's incredible stuff.
Absolutely, I mean, and it also comes. It's also fair to note that Mozart and Haydn didn't write cello pieces, and they didn't write cello sonatas, and so for a cello recital, for anyone, I'd say, the hardest thing is coming up with repertoire from the classical period. And in some ways, that's what I love to play. I love playing early Beethoven quartets and Mozart quartets and Haydn quartets. And in a recital setting, I find it hard to find a piece that is subtle enough for me to showcase the elegance that I think is important with which to play classical music. So these Beethoven variations I've found very useful to show the range of styles that I and my pianist can play.
We should point out for listeners, not musicians, that back in the early classical period, that the cello performed a very different role usually in those chamber
Absolutely.
Situations. It was just a continuo part where you're just kind of outlining the chords per se.
Most of it was just I mean, even in this Beethoven, even though he was so much later, I still double the bass line occasionally, you know, and I still act as that bass, fundamental bass part. The first person in my studies that I've come across that have given the cello a more important role was Haydn, but that was more in the role of the string quartet. Even Haydn's trios, the cello still takes a back seat. But unfortunately, there were no duos. I've tried to arrange violin sonatas or things, but nothing really works as well as these variations do. So, and there are two other sets of them. If I come back to Greensboro to play, I may play the Judas Maccabeus variations.
Why not? Hey, take on the Diabelli. Just do a transcription.
Do a transcription of the Diabelli or the Eroica variations.
Why stop there? Yeah. Interesting, too, in the program following that, most listeners familiar with Chopin and the association with piano. I happen to know from cellist friends of mine, not the easiest sonata in the world. How does this one lie? This is a beautiful, beautiful work, the sonata in G minor.
Right, so the Chopin sonata, I think, is one of the cello and piano duo's greatest pieces. It's not performed as much as I think it should be. And I think it's rarer on the concert stage than it should be. Recently, a few cellists have taken to performing it more, which I've been very happy about. But this was one of Chopin's last works, if not his last work. No, that can't be. Second to last work, right? Second to last work, and he performed the second, third, and fourth movements, I think, on his last public recital with Auguste Trancombe, the cellist he wrote the piece for. And you're absolutely right that the piano part is, I mean, Chopin's a piano composer. He wrote only a handful of pieces without the piano, no pieces without the piano, but only a handful of pieces with other instruments. Two of them were the piano concertos, which the orchestral parts are lacking, and the cello sonata, the piano trio, and I think the introduction and polonaise, brilliant. But the cello sonata has this amazingly virtuosic piano part, which is something that's a problem with cello sonata. You know, Rachmaninoff wrote a cello sonata, and Mendelssohn wrote two, and these are very, very demanding piano parts. And for the Rachmaninoff, the cello part is not that demanding, but for the Chopin, the cello part is. So the Chopin, I think, is more of an equal fight for the piano and the cello. That said, there are so many notes in this amazing piano part that it'd be hard to imagine that the cello could be an equal role with the amount of notes the piano has. But I picked this Chopin sonata also because of who I'm playing with. I'm playing with a very special pianist down in Greensboro, someone who I had the pleasure of working with last year in a chamber setting, and invited him to do all of my recitals because I thought he was that special. I mean, he has such a range of color and of dynamic, and the rubato is so natural. And I thought, you know, knowing his playing and his large and his technical prowess and capabilities, I thought that there would be no better piece for him than the Chopin Sonata. And I think that I think I was right, because he's just, I mean, to hear him play it is just remarkable.
And we're talking about pianist David Aladashvili. And what was your association with, if there was one, with the Ingrams, with this particular performance series?
Well, Lucy Ingram has always been a very close friend of my family since my father started at Eastern. And I always knew that she had this wonderful series, and she and her wonderful husband who passed, and this concert is in memory of him. And I think there's one concert per year or two concerts per year which hold that title. And it's very special for me because I think so highly of Lucy and what she's doing and what she does in Greensboro. And also that she took her time to make sure that I was someone she wanted on her series. She heard me at Eastern and then heard me again and was always there at all my performances, and I always spoke to her. And then eventually she saw enough in me that she wanted to bring me down to her series, and I'm just so excited to play there. I love Greensboro. I have all my favorite places, and I just love coming down there. And I'm looking forward to staying with Lucy, because she houses all of the artists in her home, and she is just a very special lady, and I'm looking forward to seeing her.